I am Neo. Welcome into the Skeptic Arena. Today is August 2nd, 2009. The website is theskepticarena.com. Today's subject, scientists claim breakthrough in growing human sperm from stem cells. Scientists claim to have created human sperm for the first time in a breakthrough they say could lead to a new treatment for male infertility. The sperm was grown in a laboratory in Newcastle from embryonic stem cells, led by Professor Karim Nayernia. Researchers developed a method of growing early-stage sperm from human embryonic stem cells by using retinoic acid, a vitamin A derivative. They found that about 20% of the cells produced early-stage sperm cells, or spermatogonia, and after further culture, they could see a number of cells continue to split and divide. The breakthrough came when some cells continued to grow, elongating and growing a tail, which caused them to move, and forming recognizable sperm cells. Nayernia of Newcastle University and the Northeast England Stem Cell Institute described the cells as fully mature functional sperm, which he called in vitro derived sperm. He said this is an important development as it will allow researchers to study in detail how sperm forms and leads to a better understanding of infertility in men, why it happens and what is causing it. This understanding could help us develop new ways to help couples suffering infertility so they can have a child which is genetically their own. It will also allow scientists to study how cells involved in reproduction are affected by toxins. For example, why young boys with leukemia who undergo chemotherapy can become infertile for life and possibly lead us to a solution. The scientists who created mice sperm 6 years ago using similar techniques said that he used four criteria to determine whether the cells he produced were sperm. They were the presence of proteins specific to sperm, one of which is located in the tail and very important for activating egg division, chromosome analysis, which showed that the sperm produced contained 23 chromosomes or half of the chromosome set. This is specific to sperm cells. The shape of the sperm, which has a tail and a head. And finally, the movement of the sperm. We could clearly see the movement of the sperm using the tail. But his findings, published in the academic journal Stem Cells and Development, were met by a barrage of criticism by other scientists who said further research was needed to determine the authenticity of his claims. Dr. Alan Pacey from the University of Sheffield said, "As a sperm biologist of 20 years' experience, I am unconvinced from the data presented in this paper that the cells produced by Professor Nayernia's group can be accurately called spermatozoa." After watching a video clip of the cells, he said that while they possessed some of the distinctive genetic features and molecular markers seen in sperm, there were other characteristics of human sperm that were not described in the paper. While the footage did not have sufficient resolution for him to properly assess how the sperm was moving, another indicative factor of sperm behavior. Professor Azim Sarani, a specialist in physiology and reproduction at the University of Cambridge, said the cells should be tested to find out how they develop inside an animal egg, and added, "These sperm-like cells made in a dish from embryonic stem cells are a long way from being authentic sperm cells." Professor Robin Lavelle Badge from the Medical Research Council Institute of Medical Research also questioned the findings, saying that they need much better evidence that such in vitro derived sperm are normal, but added that any progress by the team will be very important for research and ultimately, although definitely not yet, fertility treatments. Nayernia responded by saying that his research paper was clearly labeled a proof of principle, which concludes that it is in its early stages and further research is needed. He said, "We are not claiming this research is complete, but we are saying that we have found human sperm." Nayarniya added that his findings would not lead to human beings being produced in a dish, but were rather a way of investigating why some people are infertile and the reasons behind it. If we have a better understanding of what's going on, it could lead to new ways of treating infertility. And now we move to the science segment. A thinking cap that can enhance the mind's ability to learn has moved a step closer, scientists claim, after tests showed magnets can boost brain power. Researchers discovered the ability of the brain to learn a task and remember it was greatly enhanced when a magnetic pulse was applied to the premotor cortex, the area of the brain just behind the forehead. The team at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada, led by Dr. Laura Boyd, believed that the technique could be used to enhance intellectual capacity and help those with learning difficulties. Young people could be screened for Alzheimer's risk. Dr. Boyd tested the ability of 30 volunteers to track a target on a computer screen with a red dot using a joystick. During the task, the target would move randomly, then enter a program pattern and finally return to moving randomly. The participants were not aware of the repeated section, believing that movements were random throughout. Some of the volunteers had their brains stimulated by magnets while others did not. Those participants who had received the stimulation were significantly better than the other groups at tracking the target during the repeated section of the test. They showed no significant difference in improvement during the random sections. Dr. Boyd, who published her findings in the journal BMC Neuroscience, said they showed that magnetic stimulation could boost learning skills and eventually lead to a thinking cap. With this tool, we hope to be able to promote learning in patient populations who otherwise have great difficulty in acquiring new motor skills, she said. In fact, we are actively investigating this possibility right now in my lab. Meanwhile, there is hope for phobia sufferers after scientists identify the part of the brain from which fear originates. Using brain imaging, the University of Washington researchers have pinpointed the basolateral nucleus in the region of the brain called the amygdala in the center of the brain. The team who published their findings in the Public Library of Science said one day it could lead to incapacitating fears or phobias that interfere with normal functions. And now we move to the religion segment, which today replaces the normal segment, The Arena Goes Abroad. Today in the religion segment, the Shroud of Turin, made in the image of the creator, Leonardo da Vinci. The mysterious Turin Shroud, for centuries believed to be the crucified Jesus' burial cloth bearing his face impression after he was wrapped into it, may have been created by Leonardo da Vinci using his own face. A new study by Lillian Schwartz of the School of Visual Arts in New York demonstrates with computer scans that the face on the shroud has exactly the same dimensions as that of da Vinci. The Renaissance artist may have created the artifact by using pioneering photographic techniques and a sculpture of his own head. Already in 1988, carbon dating has proven that the shroud is far too young to be authentic. It could originate, however, from the Da Vinci era. Leonardo had long been suspected to be its creator, but now there seems to be proof. In their book, Turin Shroud, How Leonardo da Vinci Fooled History, Oliver Prince and Lynn Picknett proposed already in 1994 that the famous face impression was created by using an advanced photographic technique. Da Vinci was familiar with the principles of photography, which were known long before the first photographs were made in the 1820s, and he used to make experiments with camera obscura. The image on the shroud seems to be created by coating a cloth with light-sensitive chemicals, using it as a film to project the face as a photo negative. Experiments with this technique produce face impressions very similar to the relic. Now the computer scan provides the missing link to Leonardo. The shroud could be another Da Vinci code, created to immortalize the painter's own face. There has been another link found also. Studies by Oliver Prince establish that the shroud face matches the proportions of Da Vinci's Jesus painting creator, Mundi. There is no contradiction in both the theories, as creator Mundi has obviously been painted using the formula of Da Vinci's own face proportions. The same applies to the famous Mona Lisa, as Lillian Schwartz showed already in the 1980s. And now for the final segment of the show, famous quotes. Today, John Stuart Mill, born 1806, died 1873 at the age of 66. John Stuart Mill was a philosopher, political theorist, political economist, civil servant, and member of parliament. He was an influential liberal thinker of the 19th century whose works on liberty justified freedom of the individual in opposition to unlimited state control. He was an exponent of utilitarianism, an ethical theory developed by Jeremy Bentham, although his conception of it was very different from Bentham's. And now for the quote from John Stuart Mill. If there are any marks at all of special design in creation, one of the things most evidently designed is that a large proportion of all animals should pass their existence in tormenting and devouring other animals. And I see we have a guest. Guest number one, welcome into the Skeptic Arena.
Hello.
So, what subject is on your mind today? In the Skeptic Arena, the guests are allowed to discuss any subject that interests them.
That's a very generous invitation. Thank you so much. Actually, I'm ringing from the UK, and it's 2:30 in the morning here. My idea of skepticism is I don't believe anything unless I've found firm evidence for it. I'm quite happy to deconstruct anything. If it's not what it claims to be, I want to know, and I don't think that's cynicism. I think that's just common sense.
Are you a Richard Dawkins fan?
Not at all.
Oh.
Now, I'm totally skeptical about Richard Dawkins' scientific materialist reductionist philosophy, which to me is totally based on unexamined and unprovable axioms. I have come to the conclusion for myself that science, which claims to be objective and about truth, is just another religion, that it's based on, like all religions, unexamined or faith principles, axioms. In the case of science, I would say that the basic principle of materialistic science, science as it is practiced, is that reality, truth, whatever, is only that which we can first of all be examined through the five senses and then be analyzed in terms of predictions made and the repeatability of experience or experiments made, the scientific method.
Okay, I want to respond to you. Okay, as far as science being a religion, the difference between science and religion is that religion is based on faith. All religions are based on faith. None of them have ever produced one single shred of evidence that they are anything other than faith. And for people in religion who admit this, skeptics have no problem with that. If you want to believe in religion based on faith, that's fine. That's your right. But there are some people in religion who try to claim that they have evidence. They have been given thousands of years to produce this evidence, and none of this evidence has ever stood up to scrutiny. Science, on the other hand, only accepts evidence. Nothing in science is taken on faith. Faith might be likened to an hypothesis. When a scientist wants to present a hypothesis, that would be the equivalent of faith. But at that point, it hasn't become science yet. It's just a guess, a hypothesis. He may have faith that this is true, but to become science, he has to go out, gather the evidence, test it, and prove it to the majority of scientists that, in fact, it is proof. And that is what constitutes the body of science. So religious people are constantly trying to equate religion with science in an effort to gain equality with science. Religion will never have equality with science because they are two completely different methods for obtaining knowledge. One obtains knowledge and then can prove it. The other has never obtained any knowledge and has never been able to prove anything. So science and religion are as opposite as you could possibly get. And usually it's just religious people who try to equate the two. It's very unusual to have a non-religious person equate the two. But for those of you listening, we've just had a guest prove that you don't have to be a religious person to try to equate science with religion.
Thank you for being so clear and not going on and on and on. You make your point and then you stop. Thank you for that. Just to respond to what you're saying. You see, you are right within your context. To me, looking at the big picture, religions with their unprovable premises seem to be opposed by science with its provable observations using the five senses. But from my point of view, using the biggest picture I can feel and think and see, it's as if science is one side of a coin and religious faith is on the other. To me, it is the coin of belief.
Yeah, I really do need to respond because now I got two things and I don't want to get too far behind.
Okay.
I'll respond to the second thing you said about the coin of belief. They are both belief. Some people have tried to say that science isn't belief, but what you said is correct. Both are belief. However, one is belief based on evidence, one is belief based on faith. And that is one hell of a different coin. The second thing I want to respond to is your comment about the five senses. Our senses are very, very flawed. For instance, let's take vision. For thousands of years, people looked up in the sky and believed that the sun was circling the earth because that's what our senses told us. We could go through all the senses and point out their flaws. In addition to our senses being flawed, science has developed tools that enhance our senses. For instance, in vision, we've got telescopes. And not only can we see just in the visible light like we did for thousands of years, now we can see the entire electromagnetic spectrum, things that were invisible to us for eternity. Now we can see gamma rays and x-rays and everything else. So science is not limited by just the visual. It can see the entire spectrum. However, that's enhanced sense, just like our five basic senses, can lead you astray. That's where science comes in. You have to test and experiment and rule out errors and other possible interferences to come to a conclusion. And there's no guarantee that that conclusion will be correct. It will only be correct until it is replaced by something better. Or it may last forever. Who knows? So that pretty much is what I wanted to say to two things that you had mentioned.
Could you just, thank you very much, you're very clear. Could you just remind me what was your first point? Because I was going to respond to that, and then I've forgotten what it was.
I took your second one first because it was the easier, quicker one, and that is that belief is two sides of the same coin for science and other beliefs. And I was pointing out that that's true. They both do rely on belief, but they're completely opposite in the fact that scientific belief is only based on evidence and believers' belief is based on faith.
Right, thank you. If I could respond to that?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. I still maintain my point, although I acknowledge your point in its own context, but to me, the either unexamined or unprovable faith items that you're indulging in are beliefs that the five senses are the only criteria for experience or observation.
I said the opposite. I said we're not limited to just the five senses. We have created tools that have expanded greatly. Like I used the example of the telescope for vision.
But that's merely an amplification of our senses. I mean, if we talk about the senses as being hearing, seeing, touching, smelling, and tasting, it seems they're the only five we've got in that way. Then, for instance, telescopes can expand our seeing, but it's still seeing. And scientific equipment merely expands our capacity to use our five senses. I'm trying to get at a point that I don't think you're really covering. And let me put it another way, and I'll put it very succinctly and leave it. I won't go on. For instance, you talk about our ability now to apprehend the electromagnetic spectrum, so we can pretty much, through scientific instruments, observe the whole range of frequencies, which is terrific. And science, of course, is very, very good at this sort of thing because it's brilliant at expanding our apprehension of the physical universe. Of course, it is the tool par excellence. My question would be, what is it that is vibrating? I sometimes have fun taunting scientists by asking them, what is it that vibrates? And they go something like, oh, I suppose it's electrons or quarks or something, or we're trying to find out. And if you look at, for instance, the giant observatory, that thing they've done at CERN, you know, in Europe, where they've got a 10-mile donut-shaped torus that is meant to accelerate particles until they can bombard particles with other particles and get to even deeper levels of understanding of the nature of reality. Of course, from my point of view, this would be simply an ever circular route into ever finer particles, and there need be no enter. Some philosophers once said that the universe expands directly in relation to our expanding use of telescopes. And I think human consciousness is like that. So my response to you would be to say, you're absolutely right within the realm of the five senses, but I'm saying that the belief that only the five senses and their extensions through scientific tools, the belief that that is the only admissible evidence is a belief.
My question to you is, what other evidence do you have that there are more?
Good. That is the question, isn't it? And that's the beginning of a dialogue that we might take us into metaphysics rather than just in pure physics.
Sounds good.
Well, I mean, this is great because we can then perhaps discuss the validity of the people's of the meaning of, for instance, love or joy, even of intelligence, and the word consciousness comes to mind here. Because science, of course, in its reductionist nature, tries to cut out all emotion. I know scientists who really, really try to be totally objective, and they seem to have lost all feeling in their lives. They become dead. And if you look at Dawkins, he's a brilliant deconstructor of religion, but look at his personality. He's sort of psychopathic. He's not a nice man. And he has no sympathy and love for those whose religion he destroys. I don't like him at all. Don't think he's a very nice man.
You're entitled to that, but that was purely speculation on your part, a subjective opinion, which you're entitled to, but there's no way I can think of that you can prove that your opinion is correct. His wife may strongly disagree with you. His family and friends may disagree with you. People who admire him may disagree with you. Doesn't mean you're wrong. It just means that was your subjective opinion. And in the case of someone like, let's say, Hitler, you can actually bring in evidence and proof of his evilness. You've got more than just an opinion, if you want to talk about Hitler. As far as Dawkins, if you had some evidence, like you had pictures of him molesting children, you know, like beating the Catholic priest to the prime meat, then, you know, that would be evidence.
I'm merely referring to the fact that I've seen quite a few videos on YouTube of Richard Dawkins deconstructing people's cherished ideas. And when he's actually with people, he's very combative and seems to take delight in not in doing what I think is a generous thing to do, and that is to indulge in dialogue. He indulges in vituperous and debate, and he seeks to demolish his opponent. And he's like a professional wrestler or something. And he doesn't seem to have any respect for the feelings of those whose ideas he despises. And he makes it clear that he despises them. In private, he's probably the sweetest man in the world, as was Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, you're certainly entitled to your opinion. This is something kind of outside the skeptical realm. Which is fine. We're not limited just to science. It's not a boring science show. Like I say, callers can talk about anything they want, and I find it very interesting what you're saying about Dawkins. You're certainly entitled to your opinion, and I'm not going to argue with you because I've never met the man, and I've only seen the same videos you have, and people come to different conclusions. Like, you and I are looking at the same videos, and we come to very different conclusions, and that's what makes us all different, and that's what's so great about it.
I'm skeptical about anything you say. In other words, I'll examine it and think about it before I agree with you. But I'm certainly not cynical, and I don't feel antagonistic in the least towards you if you disagree with me.
Well, the reason why people call you cynical and is the same reason they call all skeptics cynical. Skeptics only accept as true that which has been proven to be true through the application of the scientific method. Believers, on the other hand, can prove nothing of what they believe. So what they're doing is they're name-calling. They are throwing insults at you, calling you a cynic,
right,
because they have no bullets in their gun. They cannot prove anything they believe, and the only thing they can do is throw the gun at you. That's why they call you a cynic. Well, I think this was a very interesting interview, and I appreciate you coming into the arena.
Are you ready, Bruce?